Hey, family, my name is Jeff Graves. I'm an alcoholic. Good to see everybody. Got a lot of my Wednesday night big book study peeps in here. Got a lot of friends. Love everybody. I have 19 years sober. I've got a sponsor. I've got plenty of sponsees. I've got grand sponsees and great grand sponsees. I love this thing. You know, when I first got here 30 years ago, I walked in and I didn't like any of you. And yet over the years, what has happened, this transformation to where when I walk in an AA room, y'all are my family. I literally look at y'all as brothers and sisters. We all have the same disease. We've all suffered tremendously from it. And now we're all in here trying to get better. Bill Wilson called it a spiritual kindergarten. And so I have to remember that sometimes when I act out and when others act out too. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Ever since I did the steps, I have had this drive in me to carry the message. And so, Tim, appreciate you asking me. I just love to carry this message in any way possible. It's not about, hey, look at me. It's about, is there anybody in the audience that's hurting, in the seats that are hurting right now? Because I do have a message for you if you're picking up a lot of white chips and trying to figure out why. I've got a lot of experience with that, what doesn't work in AA. I was born and raised in a little place south of Buffalo, New York, in New York on the Pennsylvania border. It was a farm town, real small. I had maybe 25 people in my class. And my mother was Irish Catholic. I got lots of siblings, five brothers and a sister. My father was a World War II veteran. He had come back from Iwo Jima. He was 17 when he went into the war, and he had PTSD really bad. I didn't know this growing up, but, I mean, that dude was, like, non-approachable. Things are going good. I'm going to Catholic school. I'm going to doing everything, Sunday school and all that. I'm involved in, you know, on my mother's side of the family, lots of relatives, so I'm having big celebrations on the holidays. About 8 years old, my mother develops terminal cancer and is given 6 months to live. And it kind of changed everything. Kind of a dark cloud came over everything. Now, before that, I was in the early stages of alcoholism already. I had this debilitating, just paralyzing self-consciousness. I felt everybody was looking at me. I felt everybody was talking about me. I felt everybody thought that I wasn't good enough. I just, any time that I'd walk into a room and there'd be strangers, it was paralyzing. And I've come to know that as one of the 100 forms of fear that they talk about in the big book. Mine was just paralyzing. The one thing that I knew was that if I got in fights in school, that was the one time Dad would put his arm around me and say, good job, son, if I won. Didn't go so good if I didn't win. So I got my father's approval that way. And my mom passed. I ended up, my father just went into alcoholic rage. While mom was sick and while she was on the way out, he turned violent, drinking, violent toward her, violent toward us kids. He lost his mind. So she passed, and he ended up just going out on five-day binges. So I would cook for my little brother and stuff. The siblings were out of the house. And I came to, I was about 14 or 15. And at this point, I was like, look around. I tried to get jobs. I couldn't find anything making more than minimum wage. The town was depressed. It had had oil wealth in the late 1800s, lumber wealth earlier than that. But by the time I was growing up, it was, I lived on the poor side of the tracks. My father worked in a factory. I wore hand-me-down clothes. And there was always the wealthy section of town over there, the Heights, you know. There was always the wealthy kids and stuff, but I wasn't one of them. And I wanted stuff. And I remember saying, I want to be like my dad, because everywhere I go, everybody's giving him like this accolades and saying, you know, your dad, you know. I'd walk by the fire station on the way to school, and everybody would pull me down and talk about what a hero my dad was. And I was like, this is what I need, you know. That my program for happiness early on was if I could be like my dad. Now, I can't fight in World War II, so how am I going to do this? And so I started noticing, like, doctors and lawyers and things like this had this good image, and they were driving nice cars. And so I said, well, this is what I'm going to have to do. I'm going to have to somehow, how do I break out of this minimum wage stuff? So I decided at about age 14 or 15, I got into the botanical business. So I got into botanical sales, and I was able to do really good. I ended up being like a real, you know, businessman when it came to that. And so I was able to get the motocross KLX, Kawasaki motocross bike. I was able to get the 340 Duster, and I had all the stuff, the cars. And now all of a sudden, I got the women liking me, wanting to come around me. I've always got a stack of cash and lots of other stuff. But the point is, I was just drinking very little. I could have a few beers and then just partake in botanicals and then, call it a night. Then my dad came to me when I was 19, and I'm a high school dropout. He came to me and said, "Jeff, it's time to get out of town. They're coming after you." He was real plugged in. I was like, "Well, where do I go?" And I was like, "Well, my former botanical dealer, he left 6 months ago because he had the heat on him. So I'll call them." My former botanical dealer had a son my age, so who I sponsor today. So anyway, I was like, where'd you guys go? I said, "I got to get out of town." You guys probably heard of this place. I never had. It was called Panama City, Florida. So I go down there, and it's on. That was my, Bill Wilson's I Had Arrived. That was my I Had Arrived. I'll never forget. I went down there during spring break, so it was probably March or something when Dad told me I needed to leave. And so I split, and I go down there, and I remember my friend who I sponsor now told me, put my suitcase down. That's how I had everything I owned in there, and put on my bathing suit. We went down to Miracle Strip. And I'll never forget, the song Celebrate, Kool & the Gang, was playing outside of what's Club La Vila today with these huge speakers. And I'm looking around, and there's drunk girls in bikinis everywhere. And I was like, man, So at that point, I'm calling my friends in my hometown going, "You guys got to get down here. You have no idea what you're missing." So one guy did come down. He got homesick. I was like, homesick? He went back after a month, and I never went back because it was on for me. The party was on. I still wasn't drinking alcoholically, but I turned into a hard drinker. Before, I was a social drinker. I mean, at age 6 or 7, I could have a couple drinks and call it a night. But as I got older, into my teens, moving down to Florida, I started drinking harder, still not alcoholically. I was closing down the bar some. But if I had a reason to only have 6 that night or 12, I could do that and call it a night and go home. Yeah. What's that, right? So as the time went on, I went down to the Keys in Florida and got a job on a fishing boat. And I just literally stopped doing everything for about a year because the boat work was really hard, what I was doing. It was really hard work. But I loved it. I was out with Mother Nature, going out in the ocean every day. So I did that for about a year and a half. Just abated all the alcohol and everything else. It was not a problem. Then I decided to move up to Atlanta. I got a brother that lives up here. And I came up and I got a job at TGI Fridays. It was 1982. Wildwood had just opened. And I start noticing, I'm waiting tables, and I start noticing these bartenders always seem to have a girl waiting for them at the end of the night. And they got a big stack of cash from tips, more than I was making waiting tables. And I was like, I'm going to bartend. So I worked my way into some of the hottest nightclubs in Atlanta. And as the years are going by, 1982 to 85 to 89, my drinking is really picking up. And I think it was about 1989 when I crossed the threshold from being a hard drinker to a real alcoholic. I noticed that when I drank, I couldn't always control the amount I drank. At about age 28 or 29, I noticed that, man, something's happened. Like when if I go out to just shoot a game of pool and drink a pitcher of beer, I'm waking up sometimes, in the bushes. Somebody's thrown up all over me and peed on me. I'm like, what's happening to me? And I get a job at Club Rio, which is where Rob Lowe got in his trouble. I'm hanging out with the hardcore people from South America. I got the Colombians coming up and the Peruvian flakes and everything. And I have the Dirty Cops. And I'm in the middle of everything. I got the strippers from the Cheetah 3 and from all these places coming into my bar. And I'm dialing it up. And now they're introducing me to the stuff from South America. And I find, wow, when I do this, I can drink more. And I don't realize, but I'm starting to go like this. I moved to Pat Hurley's Backyard, which was the hottest nightclub in Atlanta at the time, after Club Rio. And I start, it just starts catching me. I'm having so much fun at this point, but now I'm starting to, entering the consequence phase of alcoholism, to where I'm starting to really, I'm starting to get in more trouble. I'm getting in fights. I'm in the back of police cars a lot. Over the course of this time, I've been arrested 16 times, all alcohol related. So I get to the point where, and I got the girls hanging on me, and I'm loving that. So it gets to the point where one girl is coming up from Savannah, and she's hanging on me, and I'm telling her this is not a good idea. And she's just so cute, though. And so one night she catches me when I'm a little bit vulnerable. And it's the end of the night, and she's there, so I'm like, okay. And we start off on this torrid love affair. Heated, torrid. I forgot all about any other girl, and it was all her. And I was wrapped around the axle. And she was with me, too. So about 6 months in, we're talking about, you know, taking this thing to the next level. And she comes to me, and she says, Jeff, I'm pregnant. I'm going to have to break up with you. And I'm like, wow, you know? And so she said, it's my husband's. And I'm like, you know, the nerve of her. How dare her? I was broken, man. I mean, that broke me inside. So she said, let's have one more hurrah. My husband's at a home building convention in Vegas. Come on down, and we'll just blow it out. So I go down there, and she lives on, like, this million-dollar home on the intercoastal. They got speedboats and jeeps and everything else. I mean, a house that is just... And I remember driving back, and my guts had just been ripped out because I was like, you know what? I always knew I wasn't good enough. I always knew if somebody really ever got to know me real well, I wasn't good enough. And now I fall head over heels in love with this girl, and I just wasn't good enough. I mean, look at what this other man has given her. No wonder she broke up with me. I was just being used. And my guts were ripped out. So I'm driving back to Atlanta. And now Mr. Party Boy starts taking the stuff and going home with a bottle of vodka and doing my thing at home all by myself. And this continues for a couple of years before I start saying, I've got to do something. I've got to stop this. So I try to stop, but I notice every time I take a drink, I'm doing this other stuff. And so I'm like, well, maybe I'll just quit drinking for a little while. So I try quitting drinking. I have no luck. I can stop drinking. I just can't stay stopped. So I stopped drinking for 2 weeks, stopped drinking for 3 weeks, stopped drinking for 5 weeks. And every single time my brain would literally, and I was done. I'm done. I'm not going to drink anymore. At least for a few years, you know, cause I got to detach from this other stuff. And, I just talked myself into having one draft beer. And every time I remember, I'd be at the Dixie Tavern, and the beer would be done, and I would feel it going through my, through my body, and it would light me up like somebody administered a shot of methamphetamine in my veins. And I'd be sitting there, and I'd have the money for that draft beer underneath, and I'd head down to the Bluff. Every time I did this for 2 years. And I'd come back home, go on a 5-day run and come back home and wake up in a sweat ball crying, going, what is the matter with me? Look, why am I doing this? I'm going out of my mind. Like, I realize that I'm torpedoing out, but I don't know why. I'm totally baffled. I'd been able to surmount all sorts of obstacles growing up. And this thing called alcoholism, I didn't even know I had, was kicking my butt. And so I finally go to another AA meeting after a while, and I hear the word God, and my head explodes because God was who killed my mom and left me with that alcoholic dad. And I you know, the message I got, I don't know about anybody else. I'm sitting in church, even as a kid, as an 8-year-old. All I'm hearing is, you're screwed. That's the message. I'm scared to death. I go in there, and I'm scared at what I'm hearing because I can't behave myself. And I'm like, he even knows what I'm thinking. Like, I'm screwed. I'm going out. And So then I hear the word God and I just blow up and I leave, and King Alcohol brought me back though. So let me see what I got. Let me make sure I get to the good stuff. So anyway, those were three of the darkest years of my life, trying to stop and not being able to and not knowing why. And I finally came back to Alcoholics, and I called my buddy Russ, who was a running buddy of mine in the old days. He was one of those AA angels. This guy didn't look like an angel at all, okay? Not at all, but he was. He called me about every 2 years or 2 years and said, Jeff, how are you doing? Because he knew that where I was going. He knew where I was headed, and he got sober through going to Mar. So he had about 8 years, 6 or 8 years at the time, and he knew. I called him. I said, Russ, can you tell me about that place that you went? I didn't want to do AA, but I wanted to know about what Russ did. And so he came and 12-stepped me, and he brought someone with him. It's the first time that I got this unbelievable God shot. The guy that he brought with him was a guy from my hometown in my class. Now, you tell me what the chances, the odds are of that. It's something where in the 350 millions. You see, he brings a guy from my class. So I was mad at him because I thought that guy from my class was going to tell everybody in my hometown what a pig pen I lived in, because that place was a crack den. Woo! So anyway, I go to Charter Peachford, and I realized there over a couple week period. First of all, I walked in and I was like, these people are whacked. Like, woo! 28 days, Sandra Bullock. And by the third night, I'm thinking to myself, they keep saying things that I think. I'm identifying with everything these people are sharing. And they had us do a consequence list. They did it different ones each night, and this one was on relationships. And I sat there and I looked at my relationships with women, with police officers, with roommates, with family members. And I just was aghast. I was like, oh my God. Like, all this, none of it had to do with the South American stuff. It was all drinking. I looked at that mess, that hot mess, and said, wow, Jeff, how could you never have seen this? See, I was delusional. The disease makes me, I was delusional until I saw that mess, and I realized I need more help. So I went to Mar, where Russ did, and I stayed there for a year, and I started going to some other fellowship for a little while, but then I moved across town, and I started going to this AA meeting where they weren't really talking about the big book. I got a sponsor in there, but he wasn't really talking about doing steps. But I started a career, and I started making more money than I got out of. Obviously, I couldn't bartend anymore. So I got a career, and I started making way more money than I ever had bartending. I got married. I got the house. I got the car. I got the Rolex, and I made sure I wore that Rolex so that every. In fact, if it was back then, I'd be standing here like this telling my story, so you could all see it. Because I thought that was what was going to give me what I had, that early program for happiness that I had with my dad. If I could just get you to respect me and look up to me, then I'll be okay. Well, guess what? I got all that, and guess what? I did not treat the inside. I did not do the 12 steps and treat the restlessness, the irritability, the discontent, the self-destructive thinking. I didn't treat that. The heart of the disease of alcoholism. I did not treat that. So what happens? I'm making all this money and I've got all this stuff. And one day, it's about 5 years into my marriage, 5 years into sobriety. And I remember I looked at, my wife was across overseas at a conference. And I remember I walked by the full-length mirror. I was on my way to work one morning, and I just looked at myself in the mirror. And I was like, what's wrong? Like, it's still there. Like, what was there before I came to AA? It's still there. What is it? Like, I got the house. I got the business. I got everything I always, like, what is the matter? It was shortly after that, it occurred to me that my wife had been mistreating me. That's the problem. Now, I know it is funny because that's exactly what I did. It's something outside. It's something outside of me. And I still can't see the problems in here. And so what happens, I ran this all through my sponsor and let him know everything that was going on. I said, she's not treating me right. I'm not getting what I need at the house. She's being mean to me. And I've got this other little thing on the side shaking, and I think I'm going to take action on it. And my sponsor said, you know what? I don't blame you. I'd do it too. Problem was, I was sponsoring myself at the time. Not recommended. Not recommended. I had nowhere to go with that. It made perfect sense to me to start cheating on my wife. Of course, what happens after that? I'm nosediving. I'm in relapse, and I don't even see it. So I'm doing my thing. I'm lying to her now. I'm doing shady stuff. She can smell that girl on me sometimes. She knows something's up. It's causing friction in the house. And I'm already way headed into a relapse, and I don't even know it. And so anyway, I start relapsing, and I pick up several white chips, and I'll never forget. And I keep coming in and saying the same thing, is that I'm not going to do this. So anyway, somebody who is well known to the NAVA Club came to me and poked me in the chest when I picked up that last white chip I ever have 19 years ago. And he said, Jeff, he said it like this, Jeff, you still don't get it, do you? You know who I'm talking about, Tim. So I said, what's that, Rusty? He said, what's the first word in the first step? And he points up to the first word. And I look up and I said, we. And he pokes me in the chest and he goes, that's what you don't get. And he walks away. I chewed on that all night because I still didn't understand what he was talking about. And I was like, but I loved Rusty. I loved him. He was this nice little Christmas, like the guy on Miracle on 34th and 42nd Street. He was like him. How could you not love Rusty? And I was like, what do you mean by that? And I chewed on it, and I finally realized I'm trying to get sober on my own. And I can't do that. I need y'all. I can't get sober on my own. And so I went to this, I dropped to my knees, and then my last relapse almost killed me, by the way. I dropped to my knees, and I begged God to help me, and if you're there, please help me. And this time, I think it was the first prayer I ever really, really met. And I was sincerely, God, if you're there, please help me. And I got directed into a big book study, and this guy's up there, Joe and Charlie style, and my jaw dropped. I was like, WTF, like, dude. Like, will you please help me? I haven't been hearing this at the meeting I'm going to. Will you help me? He said all these reasons. Why is, you know, people come in and say they picked up a white chip because they did this. They relapsed because they did, you know, lost the girlfriend, lost the job. And he's like, you know, now when my sponsee said that, I'm like, really? My wife divorced me and I didn't relapse. So if your girlfriend leaving you is why you relapsed, why didn't I? Oh, really? You lost your job? Billy over there just lost his job last week, but he didn't relapse. So let's be honest. That's not why you relapsed. So this guy taught me the reason why I relapsed is because I never worked the 12 steps. And it really hit me hard. And he said there's only two reasons why you relapsed. I either didn't work the 12 steps as outlined in the book, or I didn't follow the directions after I worked the 12 steps. I didn't follow the directions to stay tapped in, tapping into the power. The reason why I relapsed was I wasn't tapped into the power. Period, end of sentence. That's why we always relapse. I'm not tapped into the power. So off it went. He took me through the steps. I'll never forget step two where he showed me we found the great reality deep within, down within us. In the last analysis, it was only there he could be found because I still had this huge, tremendous God problem. And I said, but isn't God everywhere? And he said, let's read that again. And we read it again, and it says it's only there he may be found. And he said, Jeff, you haven't found him yet. You need to look within. And I went, just like when Bill Wilson, whenever he told him, just come up with your own idea of God, because Evie tried to talk about God, and Bill wasn't having it. And Bill said that melted the icy intellectual mountain from which I stood. Bill went from religion to spirituality. I went from religion to spirituality when my sponsor showed me that, because I stopped praying to the old white dude with the white beard up in the sky telling me I was going to hell. I stopped praying to that, and I started working within. And as we went through the rest of the steps, I started feeling something and having a physical emotional response to something that was happening to me. It's called a spiritual awakening. It's a verb. It's something that happens to me. As I went through the rest of the steps, I started feeling something, something that I'd never felt before, maybe as a kid. And I was like, okay, this is, my sponsor was telling me, keep that, that's what you're going after. Whatever you're feeling right there, keep. So, you know, what I've learned is going through the steps, God has become more of a verb to me than a noun. Something that happens to me, something I feel in the morning when I'm praying in meditation. So this idea of whatever that was is not what I pray to in the morning. Spirit of the universe, Bill gives us that example in the book. That's mine. I've tapped absolutely, positively, 1,000% tapped into something that's orchestrating my life when I take my hands off the steering wheel. It does not orchestrate my life when I'm driving. I have to take my hands off the steering wheel and surrender. Sobriety to me is a constant series of surrenders. Surrender, surrender, surrender. When I do, the magic shows up. So, step three, it's what the whole program is about. I can't manage my own life. So I need to tap into this power to start getting some guidance. And so it's what the whole program is designed to do, is step three. How do I turn over the self-destructive thinking that causes problems with relationships? I can't hold jobs. I'm chaotic. You know, constant controversy and bad relationships with women and violence and, you know, all this stuff, this thinker that I got. It doesn't work. Even when I stop drinking, it gets worse. So I've got to tap into something that's going to give me direction so that literally my intellect becomes the servant rather than the master. When my intellect is the master, I end up in jail, dead, or drinking, or whatever. So I've got to do, so that's step three. Step four and five is where I learned that I'm scared of people. I'm terrified of people. I'm terrified about what you think about me. I'm terrified that I'm not good enough. And when I saw that all over my resentments, I was able to kind of back up and say, you know, my sponsor was like, why do you think they can hurt you if they think less of you? And I had to really look at that mess. I had 127 resentments. I had to look at that mess, self-seeking. I was looking for something from you. I wanted your approval. Desperately wanted your approval. So I was the guy that could walk in the room and have 29 of you high five, be so happy to see me, but one of you not? And I'm sitting there stewing about the one that didn't. Well, I gave him a ride home from the meeting 2 months ago. But, you know, and now I'm up in my head for 3 weeks about having conversations with what I'm going to do next time I see him, then he'll say this, and I'll, you know, woo! I need to just back up. So I learned that people can't hurt me even if they think less of me. I learned through going through the steps who I was. When I finally learned who I was and what my purpose was, all that went away. I'm shielded, but for the most part, from what people think about me. I love it when somebody comes up and says, yeah, it was a great job. But if somebody comes up and says, that was awful. I've had guys come up and basically, after I told my story, and basically tell me I was full of crap. And I've been like, you know what? It's okay. I feel sorry for that guy because he thinks I'm up here lying, that this isn't available. And it is, if I do the stuff outlined in the book. Happiness, joy, peace, peace of mind. So let's go to step 6 and 7. I cannot do step 6 and 7 if I don't have a connection with his power. It says in the big book that we could have moral and philosophical convictions galore, but the needed power isn't there to carry them out. We're talking about an abstinence in sobriety. I don't have the power to be a better son. I don't have the power to be a better brother. I don't have the power to be a better employee. I want to be. I desperately want to be better. I desperately want to do this, but I can't. I fail. I can just get all the willpower I got up, and I could be good for a few weeks, but that old Jeff always shows back up with the self-destructive thinking. So I've got to tap into this power in order to have a defense against that. So AA and tapping into this power is not just about not drinking. It's about becoming the man that I'm designed to be. And I'm telling everyone right here, right now, I can promise you, if you live the 12 steps as a way of life, the person that you were designed to be will show up. And you will be blown away at what that person is. Every one of us, we're not bad people. We're sick. We've got just really messed up thinking. And the 12 steps straighten out that thinking and give me a design for living that really works. 10 minutes? Oh, no. I'm open. Okay. Yeah, give me 10 minutes because I got some good stuff. So anyway, amends. I told my mom a month before she died, I was mad at her, and I said, I hope you die of cancer. Isn't it true that we hurt and scar the people who love us the most? I hadn't even started drinking yet. She came to me and hugged me and said 5 times, repeated, I know you didn't mean that. She knew what that was going to do to me. You guys taught me how to make that amends. I wrote a letter. My sponsor had me say goodbye as well as a letter because I never got to say goodbye to her the way she just, you know. So I went up to her grave in upstate New York and read the letter, and it helped, you know. That's one of those I would have taken back. That was just pure evil. Worst thing I ever did in my life was tell my mom, the only person who ever loved me unconditionally, I hurt the most. That's alcoholism. Let's go to step 11. I got to remember, I can't have a working relationship with this power if I'm not doing step 11. I just can't. Man, it could take, I heard this, this priest at Ridgeview used to always say, if you do nothing else when you wake up in the morning, say, good morning, God. It'll change your life if you say it every day. And so I always remembered that, you know. So I wake up in the morning and verbally say out of my mouth before I start thinking about my day, I think about God and I bring him in and I say, good morning, God. What can I do for you and your kids today? Because that is why I'm still alive, is to serve the power. It's the only reason why I'm still here, is to carry this message and to serve God, period, end of sentence. I know it. And so let's go to some of the things that have happened to me. I remember when I got sober, I was like, never be able to hang out with my brothers anymore. We all drank and, you know, party and merry. So I'm thinking that's over with. And little do I know what God's got planned. I'm driving. I've got a year sober. This would have been 18 years ago. I'm going through a divorce. And my older brother, who I talked about, I didn't push it on him, but he was drinking himself to death. But he had, like, you know, 600 employees. He was managing 3 hospitals, so he was a big dog, and he pulled it up. I didn't realize how bad it was until his wife told me. He says, Jeff, I'm going through a divorce now. Why don't you fly up to Pennsylvania? We'll drive up to see our brother in New York. Both of them are still drinking actively heavy or alcoholically. And so I said, sure, Fritz. I fly up to Pennsylvania. We're driving over the Pocono Mountains, and I say something to Fritz, and he says, where'd you get that? And I said, guy named Bill Wilson. I just said something about how I was handling my divorce. And he was like, so anyway, I pulled out the 12 and 12, and I read 2 paragraphs. And while we're going over the Pocono Mountains, it's a beautiful spring day. I'm choking up when I'm trying to read these 2 paragraphs, which I still don't know what they were. I just remember 2 paragraphs, and I can hardly get them out. And I could feel the presence of God intensely in the car. And so my brother gets quiet after I read them, and then he goes, Jesus Christ, Jeff, who wrote that? And so I said, it was a guy named Bill. You know, Fritz, I've been telling you about this. He goes, is that what you guys do in AA? We go up to New York. He continues drinking. I fly back to Atlanta. 3 days later, I get a call from him. He says, Jeff, I just left an AA meeting. I'm quitting drinking. He has not had a drink. Now, I didn't want him getting involved in the same kind of AA I was involved with 30 years ago. So I said, let me take you through the first 5 steps, and then I'm going to dump you off on somebody up there. I have no idea what kind of AA you're going to. So I took him through the first 5 steps, and I remember we asked that question, is there anything you left out? And he called me back an hour later, and he said, Jeff, he said, I was going to take this to my grave, but he said, right before I called you and asked you to come up, I had a gun in my mouth. That was why I felt that in the car. That was, God was using me as a conduit to reach his dying son, my brother. And that's why I felt that. If the presence of God was overwhelming in the car, it was because he was dying. I didn't even know it. He had just about taken his life just before that. Then he goes up, my younger brother comes in a year later. we sit around and go camping. This idea that I wasn't going to have a relationship with my brothers anymore was a little misguided. I have a better relationship with them than they're such a gift. Let's go to a guy I had. I told you I sponsor my former botanical dealer's son. He called me a few years ago and just said, Jeff, did you tell me you quit drinking? He came through like 15 years before that. And I said, yeah. He goes, can you tell me about that? And now he's got like 3 years sober. And so I got a guy that called me on Christmas Eve. He said, will you come say a prayer for I just bought a house and I'd love you to come see. He was the guy we were seeing in DeKalb County Jail. I hadn't talked to him in like 5 years because he'd moved on. And I said, Rick, sure. I didn't want to, but I said, yeah, I've been told if you can do it, Jeff. And I could do it. So I said, Rick, sure. So I go over there and I got no idea what's about to happen. He's gotten the right to go back into DeKalb County Jail or some jail, and he's pulled two other guys out of there. And so we've got kids. There's five or six children running around, their wives, two sober men and Rick, third sober man, their wives. And I walk into this and I realize this happened because we brought AA meetings into DeKalb County Jail. These little children got their dad back. And to me, being raised by an alcoholic father, it just means more to me than anything. So the little girl, she's 8 years old now. His little girl that he's had, because that's why he said in the jail, he goes, I just had a little baby girl and I need to get sober. And so anyway, I'm holding her little hand. It's a tiny little hand. And she's sitting next to me and she says, hold on before you say grace. I want to know what you look like. Can I touch your face? That little girl got her dad back. Blind girl, special needs girl, got her dad back. I'll tell you what, I drove, when I went home that night, I was like, I am so glad that I said yes to service. And this, it was the greatest gift I got all year. Got another guy, came in, took him through the steps, angriest guy ever, redneck Cobb County, racist, homophobic, he hated everything. And He's about 6'3" and about 245 pounds. He was a bad ass. Anyway, so it's so funny because I take him through the steps, and the very first sponsee he gets, I'm standing there talking to him, and a black dude comes up and goes, will you sponsor me? And he looks at me, and then he looks at the guy, and he goes, sure, absolutely. He calls me that night and said, Jeff, you know what? I just want him to get what you showed me. So a week later, the guy comes walking in. Richard's sitting down in the chair. Guy comes walking in, dressed like a peacock. He's in full drag. Sits down next to Richard. And Richard is like, calls me that night and he said, you know what, Jeff, I just don't care. I just don't care. I just want him to get this. See, this is the transformation from the 12 steps. He calls me about 5 years later. Richard, I hadn't talked to him. He moved to the other side of town, got another sponsor. He calls me and says, Jeff, I want to talk to you. Can I, let's have dinner. And he walks in and he's lost at least 50 pounds. He's skinny as a rail. And I could tell that something bad has happened to him. And he sits down and I said, Richard, you know, what happened? And he said, Jeff, a year ago, I was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer and given 1 year to live. And he said, I just wanted to bring, and he's looking at me with these blue eyes, and he's looking across the table, and he said, total peace, just peace. And he's thanking me. He said, I never could have gotten through this without my relationship with God. And I will never forget, he looked at me, and he goes, as soon as I got diagnosed, I just gave it to God. And he said, I haven't worried about it one bit. He said, but I'm worried about my mother because I take care of her. He'd been taking care of her for years. She was an invalid. He calls me a couple weeks later and said, Jeff, my secretary found a life insurance policy for me that's going to pay Mom $250,000 when I die. How does that happen? He's already outlived his diagnosis. I'll tell you how it happens to faith. That man had faith. That man had faith like I'd never seen before. I learned more from him than he ever learned from me. Man, that was powerful. So I guess I'll just leave it at that. I want to tell you that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me everything I ever ever didn't even know I wanted. I learned as time went by, my relationships, my deep, meaningful relationships with you people are what mean more to me than any material thing. Somewhere along the lines, I just lost the desire for all this material stuff. I've had a Rolex sit in my thing for like 7 years. I don't even wear it anymore. It just doesn't even matter to me. It just all that stuff about who, you know, it doesn't matter to me. What matters to me is my relationships with y'all, my relationships with my family members, these deep, my connection with God. And I realize I have this incredibly beautiful life. I'm at peace today. I have serenity in my life. I'm not at war with the world anymore. And this is available to all of us, but it takes time. If you're new, you're in your first year or two, there's a lot of ups and downs, but stick with it. And stick close to the people that are doing the work and doing this work. And I promise you, as time goes by, the ups and downs are going to start going like, every once in a while you'll get it, you know, but they're going to start going like this. And you're going to notice over a course of time, I get to where I'm just at peace with the world now. I realized the other day, I'm a Libra, and I really am, the sign of the scales, I really am in harmony with God's universe today. I came in here at war with it. What's that but transformation? Thanks, everybody.
First I slip, and then I trip to a hope-filled dream. You rescue me, and finally in there I see. I look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promise is. Sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, God wants us, we walk eternally. Take me where the promise is.